So I'm here today with Eamon, and we will be discussing the state of the jihad in Syria. So for those of you who are interested, this would include who are the groups operating, what are their ideologies, and then how do we factor in Iraq, and then finally ending hopefully with sort of the politics and where these jihadi groups involve themselves in the politics of the Syrian civil war and the politics of the Syrian insurgency. So let's start off with, update us on the Syrian jihad, because I think our last show was in December of 2012. So it's been about six, 7 or 8 months. So, walk us through. I mean, who are the key players? Is it still Jabhat al-Nusra?
I mean,
How much? Oh, go ahead.
you still got Jabhat al-Nusra, and by all accounts, they're still active across all parts of the country, and they still regularly release statements through their official media channel called Al-Manara al-Baida. But it was complicated all a bit in April, because Sheikh Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who heads the Islamic State of Iraq, which is Iraq's al-Qaeda branch, and announced that Jabhat al-Nusra and his ISI were one and the same and should be henceforth called Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem. And then however, Sheikh Julani, of the leader of Jabhat al-Nusra, while he admitted, of course, yes, we started off, we took funds from Baghdadi, we from ISI, and actually a large number of the core leadership of Jabhat al-Nusra are Syrian people who are Syrian mujahideen who fought in the Iraq War, against the Iraqi government, against coalition forces, and so on. But Julani didn't accept the idea of merging into ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem. He said, actually, no, I wasn't consulted about this. And then after that point, Al-Manara al-Baida went offline, and from during that time and between that time, April the 9th, I think it was, and early June, Al-Manara al-Baida was offline. So we had to rely on unofficial Facebook media pages and so on, and YouTube videos to try to track what Jabhat al-Nusra and what would now emerge in Syria as people calling themselves under the banner of Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem, were doing. And then in June, of course, came al-Zawahiri's letter, Ayman al-Zawahiri's letter, where he stated that Jabhat al-Nusra and ISI were to remain separate, and that he hadn't ordered for the merging of the two branches of Al-Qaeda. Because Julani, just to emphasize, did in his statement rejecting the merger, did nonetheless reaffirm his pledge of allegiance to Zawahiri. So it's still an Al-Qaeda affiliate, regardless of whether he accepted Baghdadi's decision or not. But I mean, that statement notwithstanding, it's clear that ISIS is a reality on the ground in Syria. The actual terms of the relationship between the two groups, Jabhat al-Nusra and Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem, it's important not to assume too strict a dichotomy of inherent hostility. So there are some parts of Syria where Jabhat al-Nusra has maintained a very distinct identity. The best example of that is in Deraa in southern Syria, just bordering Jordan, where the only evidence you can find is of Jabhat al-Nusra. There's no one there calling themselves by the name of Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem. Elsewhere, it's all a bit more complicated. So in the city of Aleppo itself, Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and Hashem are two quite separate entities. So most notably, when they put out separate statements, and also Jabhat al-Nusra uses a seal, stamp seal insignia, identifying itself as part of the Sharia Committee in Aleppo, whereas ISIS is not part of that. Also in the city of Deir ez-Zor in the east of the country, they're two separate entities. Again, issuing separate statements on their attack, on their operations they carry out, and so on. Also in the Damascus area, there's, I think, quite a clear separation. I mean, it's only fairly recently that ISIS moved into Damascus area. They've actually established a training camp named after Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And also, I'd say in the Hama area as well, also in central Syria, there seems to be a separation. But in other places like Raqqa in the north, and in the surrounding countryside, also in the eastern towns outside of Deir ez-Zor, so also in Hasaka Governorate and also in Deir ez-Zor Governorate, but outside the city, so along the Euphrates of all the smaller towns, there's a lot more blurring between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. One might say, oh, I'm a member of Jabhat al-Nusra, but it doesn't mean you're hostile to the Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham. Or you might use both banners and both names. Actually, I think the clearest case for readers to see how that acts out is, in this recent case of Islamist groups fighting Kurdish battalion, fighting the Kurdish PYD. A lot of sources, they use Jabhat al-Nusra and Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham interchangeably. That's because there is not really, in the Hasaka governorate in particular and in the Raqqa area, there's not a clear distinction between the two. And so that's why I say you have to avoid posing a strict dichotomy between the two and always assume that, well, if you identify yourself as Jabhat al-Nusra, it must mean that you're hostile to the Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham. No, that's not the case. In terms of who actually is a member of each of these groups, Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, the tendency in the media has been to say that, well, the foreign fighters, for the most part, joined ISIS, whereas native Syrians remained members of Jabhat al-Nusra. My own research does corroborate that to an extent. If you look at the claimed martyrs, people killed themselves in a suicide operation, got killed in fighting, so on, put out by pro-ISIS media outlets, like the channel Asham, which is based in Raqqa, the city of Raqqa, you find that a lot of most of the claimed martyrs, so-called martyrs, are actually foreign fighters, disproportionately Saudis and Tunisians. However, it's not always, that dichotomy also is not always accurate. So actually, in some of the northern, rural North Aleppo, you've got mostly native Syrian fighters who, say, once used the banner of Jabhat al-Nusra, now going by Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham. The best case of that is the border town of Jarablus, which ISIS seized violently. They were in the town for quite some time. They seized it, complete control of it, violently from a battalion going by the label of Free Syrian Army that was called the Family of Jadir. And there's a violent power struggle there in mid-June, but now ISIS controls the town. Turning again back to those eastern areas outside the city of Deir ez-Zor, where I said there was blurring. Good case of that, actually, and a good case of that, again, the problem of a strict dichotomy of foreigner and native Syrian. There's a battalion in Abu Kamal, which is just on the border with Iraq, on the Euphrates. There's a battalion there called Kataib Janud al-Haq. They were set up as a detachment of Jabhat al-Nusra in that area. When Baghdadi announced ISIS, they started calling themselves, they switched their imagery to reflect the Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham in their logo. And eventually by mid-May, they were calling themselves Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham Deir ez-Zor area. However, that didn't mean they were hostile to Jabhat al-Nusra, because actually they put up things on their Facebook page praising Jabhat al-Nusra and so on. Now that Zawahiri announced reaffirmed the separation between Jabhat al-Nusra and Islamic State of Iraq, now Kataib Junud al-Haq again reverted to calling itself a part of Jabhat al-Nusra. They still didn't change their logo, which incorporated ISIS imagery. Moreover, they actually didn't. They still put up photos of their fighters waving the ISIS flag, and they even. But again, contrary to the foreigner-native-Syrian dichotomy, it actually appears a large number of those fighters of the Kataib Junud al-Haq are actually Iraqis. Actually, the Facebook page is being operated within Iraq, which is suggesting links with Iraqi Mujahideen. So that's the state, I'd say, so far of Islamic State Iraq Nisham and Jabhat al-Nusra. It's a lot more of a complex relationship than one of simple hostility and dichotomy. And I don't see, you know, necessarily an open conflict happening anytime soon between the two groups, between members of the two groups on the ground, despite the fact that the dispute at the leadership level remains unresolved, because Baghdadi, after Zawahiri made his statement, made clear that he rejected the idea of keeping his group separate from Jabhat al-Nusra. Do you want me to continue, or was?
I wanted you to mention, how does a recruitment? How are these groups recruiting from within Syria? Not just foreign fighters, but how are they recruiting Iraqis and Syrians to participate in, this larger struggle against the Assad regime?
It's a mixture of what. A lot of rebel battalions do a mixture of what I'd say would be coercion and outreach. In what ISIS does, for example, what ISIS has done from what I've monitored, for example, they outreach to people in the hope, also in the hope of gaining fighters, that they distribute pamphlets saying a pamphlet on who are the Nusayris, i.e. the Alawites, what are their beliefs and what are the rules on fighting them. They also put out pamphlets, why God's law, why the Sharia. Put up billboards in the city of Raqqa, encouraging people to wear the, women, for example, to wear the niqab and the burqa. They do outreach in the mosques, have preachers who are aligned with them, to preach the message of jihad. Also holds what public dawah meetings, outreach, idea of strengthening people's faith. They've done that in ISIS, for example, did that in a number of towns. ISIS is somewhat aware of the fact that there's sort of an ongoing PR war between them and people who are affiliated with Salim Idris's Supreme Military Command, the SMC, which wants Western arms. And one thing they want to counter is the idea they're just a bunch of insane people who don't give any regard for locals whatsoever. So one thing that ISIS does, they put out propaganda on forums, so on, emphasizing how, say, they outreach to children and, for example, with Quran study circles in various villages.
So, how has my Arabic pronunciations are a little weak, but how has Qaradari's statement calling the Syria a jihad, to go to war in Syria, I think it's a jihad, or I forget the exact terms of how he described it, but how has that changed recruitment? Are we seeing more foreign fighters coming into Syria with intention of pursuing jihad against the Assad regime, or, is this really more of a sort of PR statement on his part?
I think it reflects more. I haven't seen any evidence of a specific statistical upsurge in foreign fighters because of, say, that it could tie it to the statement that Qaradawi made about jihad. But what I do think is that, his call for jihad reflects a new normal for the regional discourse on it. To talk about Alawites as Nusayris and so on, and to talk about the Shia as being Rafidites and so on, and to talk about the need for jihad. It's becoming seen, I think, as much more normal in the region. And I think it, to the extent that it did alarm the pro-military circles in Egypt, after Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood said, we won't prosecute citizens who go to fight in who go to fight in Syria. And now you have the new Egyptian transition government saying, no, we're not going to call for jihad in Syria. So, you know, definitely that, you know, the Khaled Dawi statement was one good example of a shift in the discourse, you know, towards much more open calls for jihad. In contrast, say, maybe about a year ago, it was more confined just, say, to fairly, just more Salafist circles. But, you know, Khaled Dawi is seen as close to the Muslim Brotherhood. So I'd say, yeah, definitely normalization of the discourse of jihad in the region of the Syrian civil war.
I mean, what is, in your view, then, what has been the process that has led to that change? I mean, if we're saying that a year ago, you know, this discourse wasn't even, you know, was only in within Salafi circles, within, you know, a small group of people, and now you have, you know, somebody that is largely considered, not necessarily mainstream, but definitely...
He's no doubt considered mainstream in that part of the world. I mean, considering his large following base. But yeah, just the fact the conflict's been going on for so long, and you know, it wasn't the quick victory people expected. And I don't know how many people, and say I lost count number of people in 2012 who were saying, you know, that the end of the Assad regime would come in that year, but actually no, persisted. Survived 2012, and probably probably will survive 2013. But you know, also another problem I think was in Syria itself. You know, you had the problem that the FSA, people who are going by the label of the FSA in particular, got the association of being, you know, criminals and thieves and so on in the eyes of many locals as well. So you had definitely a more Islamic shift on the ground with various rebel groups. I'll give you an example, actually. A non-Al-Qaeda battalion. So there's one coalition of battalions called the SILF, Syrian Islamic Liberation Front. They're not Salafist. For the most part, they're not Salafist. Most of them are just regular Sunni Islamist or, you know, Muslim Brotherhood kind. One of the battalion groups there is one called Kataib al-Farouk, Farouk Battalions. And their first emblem they put out, logos, you know, was quite proud, prominently displaying the Free Syrian Army flag, and much more of a leaning, I think, towards secular nationalism. Even though the Homs division of the group, where it first emerged, is actually had very close links to the Ikhwan. Going further north in the country, that's less so. But in the north in particular, in their, say, conflicts with other rebel groups for control of border access and so on, they got got a reputation of being gangs of thieves. And now that they, I think to try to counter that perception, a lot of the groups outside the Salafist jihadist circles, they definitely shifted to trying to be more Islamic. So Farouk dropped... Farouk made the FSA flag much less prominent in their new emblem, and they actually put up the white flag with the Shahada in black to signify the realm of Dar al-Islam and the rule of God's law and so on. So I think also, you know, just on the ground, you know, you had, I think, a more Islamic shift over time in self-presentation by various rebel groups. So also, I think, in the Islamic world, I think the wider Muslim Middle East and Arab world and so on, that perception came out. You know, the more secular groupings weren't successful and weren't quite so heroic. And then you have that more Islamic shift, as I say, over time.
So how would you describe, you know, the nature of sectarianism of this conflict then? I mean, it seems like, you know, as somebody who is, you know, as a layman, I would say that it's incredibly sectarian. I mean, it seems like if a lot of these guys are employing the language of rejection, describing Alawis and Shiites as rejectionists.
Then... And the Sayri, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
so, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd say definitely that, you know, there's no doubt that just over time it become more and more sectarian. I think one thing though to be cautious of, I think a couple of things to be cautious of. First would be that I'd say that, you know, when people were first writing on how the protests in Syria broke out and so on, with you know, as you know, the non-sectarian discourse, I think that was focusing, you know, too much on the cities itself. On the, you know, the major urban centers of Syria. I mean, I think rural Syria always had more of that feeling of sectarianism. Just like in Iraq, you had more, you know, sectarianism become much more apparent even before 2003, say, if you weren't in Baghdad, you know, where there have been quite a lot of, say, intermarriages between Shia and Sunni. And the same way in Syria, I think, in rural Syria, you know, you would know which village was Sunni, say, which village was Alawite, or which was mainly Sunni or mainly Alawite, and so on. I think the in the rural areas, the sectarian divisions are always much more apparent. And I think, you know, given that the whole protest movement broke out as a rural peripheries to urban center in terms of the development of unrest over time, it can be a bit too easy to overlook, you know, what was the nature of rural Syria. Same reason why people might think, you know, well, Syria may be a secular country, but why, you know, the Salafi, why are Salafi groupings? So, you know, why is, say, the SIF, the Syrian Islamic Front, the Salafi coalition of battalions, why are they so successful? Well, I think, you know, part of that success gets explained by the fact, you know, that one has to be very careful about saying, you know, that, oh, Syria is a secular country. I think that's mainly true of the urban centers. And if you went outside of that, you would see that, I think, over time, definitely, but well before the uprising had happened, that people had become much, much more religious over time. And actually, you know, to an extent, that reflects a wider shift in the Islamic world since the 70s towards greater religiosity.
So let's switch gears a bit, and because I think I'm kind of interested in seeing how Iraq has sort of shaped the Syrian jihad. And, you know, not just in the sense of religion or in the sense of groups, but rather, you know, describe, you know, Iraq's role in this. I mean, in both in terms of providing recruits and sort of this physical space, because it seems a lot like, you know, Western Iraq and Eastern Syria is where, I mean, you know, these groups are coming from or based in and sort of, you know, moving from. So, I mean,
yeah, then there's,
Iraq.
There's definitely, you know, no doubt that there's, you know, movement between the borders for fighters of in the Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham in particular. And again, also, it's important to emphasize, you know, despite the leadership disagreement in Jabhat al-Nusra between Sheikh Julani of Jabhat al-Nusra and Sheikh Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi of Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham, that, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra still get, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra's origins as Syrian Mujahideen who'd fought in Iraq. And there's no doubt that, you know, the financial links and, you know, supplying of weapons continues both ways, you know. And Zawahiri, you know, emphasized very clearly in his letter that while JN and ISI should remain separate, that there should nonetheless continue a spirit of cooperation between the two. So there's that, you know, movement between the borders. I wouldn't say it's quite like Lebanon yet, where the border areas have become literally lawless zones. But it's increasingly going that way. An interesting thing actually to note is the question of Iraqi fighters in Syria. So I told you about how, you know, when I looked at martyrs, claimed martyrs for ISIS, I said there's disproportionately Saudi and Tunisian. There's a motive to downplay the role of Iraqi fighters, actual Iraqis who've come to fight for the Mujahideen in Syria. There's, you know, the problem of in Iraq when the brutalization of the local population that sparked the beginnings of the Anbar Awakening or the Sahwa in 2005. And then that's widely now known throughout the Arab world, you know, such that, you know, whenever Western reporters come along and there's a conflict, there's signs of a conflict, say, between Al-Qaeda-aligned groups and non-Al-Qaeda alliance, say like in Libya, they'll say, you know, we want to form a SAFWAR against Al-Qaeda in whatever country, Libya or Syria, what as well. You know, a lot of rebels, they're speaking to the media, will play up that idea. So as I say, there's a jihadi sources actually tend not to, they don't want to emphasize the role of Iraqi fighters too openly because of this bad associations of brutality and so on. But as I say, there's no doubt that they actually are in, there's movement between the borders and there are Iraqis fighting in Syria. And actually, quite an exception to the rule was this killing of an FSA-aligned commander in Latakia. He was said to have been killed by a guy called the person responsible, one of the ISIS guys responsible, was a guy called Abu Ayman al-Iraqi. Quite obviously, Abu Ayman the Iraqi, you know, an Iraqi mujahid. But I say there are some signs of it if you look hard enough. So with this Kataib Janud al-Haq that I discussed earlier, there's no doubt that there are Iraqi fighters in it. And it was a very good giveaway when I found out that their Facebook page was being operated from within Iraq. In other terms, you know, in the protests that broke out in Iraq, the Sunni protests, to tie it to the Syrian struggle, were the pro-Al-Qaeda circles. So in, say, Fallujah demonstrations, you could see Al-Qaeda flag along with a Free Syrian Army flag. But then over time, it became more normal for other protest groups, like the Sunni Popular Movement, which is not Al-Qaeda aligned. It's actually more like Salafist in orientation, Islamic Army of Iraq kind of thing. They, you know, quite regularly now putting up pictures of their demonstrations featuring FSA flag, and recently one of their pages put up something saying, a Sunni Popular Movement Facebook page, they put up a picture of a FSA flag in a demonstration, and they said, you know, God, give us an army to deliver us from the darkness, you know, the darkness of the current Iraqi government and so on. So that's, you know, how, you know, interplay across both borders is working out. And I think, yeah, it, over time, there's no doubt increasing problem of, you know, a lack of a clear border, say, between parts of Western Iraq and Eastern Syria.
So I'm curious, what has been the role of the Iraqi government? Because it seems like if the discourse of these groups in Iraq is just as much anti-Assad as it is, you know, anti-Maliki. I mean, what has been, you know, do you see that the reaction of the Iraqi government is sort of,
well, of course,
inflaming?
Yeah, the Iraqi government's official stances say, well, we have, we're actually neutral in the Syrian conflict and we want a negotiated settlement. I think what could best be described, I think the best way, for the most part, to describe the Iraqi government's own approach under Maliki is to say, you know, it's passively supporting Bashar al-Assad by not stopping Iraqi fighters from, Iraqi Shia fighters from Iranian proxy groups for the most part, Sayyid al-Haq, Kataib Hezbollah. You know, just to note that there's not really a clear-cut boundary between these groups, actually, in the same way that there are other battalions in Syria that sound like they're just for foreign fighters and they seem to be separate from ISIS, but actually they're not, like the Jaish al-Muhajirin, which is led by a Chechenian, but it's actually it is just a front group for ISIS. But anyway, back to the point about the Iranian proxy groups in Iraq. Yeah, I say they're not really, they're more like mirror friends for one another. And then I say the Iraqi government's policy has been to, you know, just not stop them from going. The same way they don't really stop Iranians from sending over aid over to Assad over Iraq's airspace. So that's how it's working out. And, you know, the problem is that evidence comes light from Facebook pages of Iraqi Shia fighters, you know, who've been killed in Syria and so on. Whereas remarkably, Hamas, which also officially maintains a neutral standpoint, in it's a good contrast. Hamas officially says it's neutral, but and they deny sending any fighters over there. And then there are some media reports that have claimed they're Hamas fighters. But if you look at the social media pages, there's actually no evidence that you know of actually fighters for Hamas having been killed in Syria or have been claimed as martyrs. They've actually all come from Salafist circles who are opposed, you know, who see Hamas as, you know, not a true resistance group and so on. But, you know, Hamas doesn't stop Salafi fighters in areas where, you know, where it has control, like Gaza. It does not stop those Salafis, say, from Gaza, from going to Syria to fight. You know, it's a double, kill two birds with one stone, get rid of Salafist rivals, you don't, you know, let Salafis go kill themselves in Syria. But at the same time, you can symbolically say, by, you know, not stopping them from going, that you're supporting the Syrian uprising.
So, look, you know, for the last part of the program, let us switch to, you know, the wider insurgency in Syria, and particularly, you know, what is Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS's relationship with the wider insurgency? I mean, is it? I mean, you know. Particularly, how are they changing that insurgency? Because it seems like, you know, I think you've already made the point that sort of, you know, secular fighters are seen as not useless, but not as effective. And so it seems like, you know, things are becoming more Islamist, Salafi, you know, walk us through this. I mean, how has, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS sort of changed the nature of the Syrian insurgency, of the Syrian civil war?
Well, actually, I'd say the biggest change in terms of the overall face of the insurgency did come from the rise of the SIF, you know, the coalition of Salafist battalions. I mean, ideologically speaking, regarding them, a tendency in the media has been to say, well, you know, the SIF is Afrar al-Sham, which is its largest battalion, I'd say. That they're a strict Salafi nationalist and that they therefore don't have sympathy for the transnational goals of Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. But I'd say that's actually false because, firstly, if one looks at the statement that Afrar al-Sham, for example, put out about the Jolani's renewal of his pledge of allegiance to al-Qaeda, they said, well, that's not in the overall insurgency's interest. But at the same time, they're talking about things like, you know, artificial borders imposed on the Ummah. They didn't talk about things like, you know, the Syrian people, or they didn't talk about it in a nationalist way. So that's a good example, I'd say, of blurring also in the SIF's outlook on how whether they're actually just limited to Syria or, as I actually think, transnationalist. Actually, you know, the Afrar al-Sham congratulated ISIS for this recent claimed prison break, jailbreak in Baghdad, in Abu Ghraib and Taji prisons. And, you know, in terms of whenever there's a conflict between Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS and, say, a non-Islamist group of people, you can always expect that the Salafi, Afrar al-Sham or SIF, they will always take Jabhat al-Nusra's and ISIS's side. So in June, some families of rebels of rival battalions in the city of Raqqa, like the Farouk battalions, they held protests outside the headquarters of Jabhat al-Nusra / ISIS, as I've said, that they're interchangeable in Raqqa. And they're saying, you know, oh, these Islamists, they have detained our relatives, we haven't seen them for a month, and so on. And then in response, the ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, and Afrar al-Sham supporters came out, you know, having their own counter demonstrations, and since Al Arabiya, the Saudi news channel, you know, had, say, picked up on the protests, some of their supporters were interviewed by activists, and they're saying, where is Al Jabhat Al Arabiya? Where is the Al Arabiya front? Referring to the what they saw as slanderous attacks on Jabhat al Nusra. And also, again, to give another example, in the Kurdish conflict, Ahrar al-Sham and Jaish al-Tawheed, which is one of the more prominent eastern SIF groups, taking Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS's side against the Kurdish, against the PYD in the Hasaka province. With the people who go by the label of FSA, Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS relations are a bit more complicated. As I said, I think the biggest case of rivalry is with people who go by the label of people who are aligned with Salim Idris's SMC, Supreme Military Command, which is based in exile. People who go by the label of FSA and aligned with SMC, I think that they're probably the number one opponents of ISIS specifically. In the current Syrian civil war. And actually, you can probably find that they're responsible for most of the stories recently, that have alleged internal Jabhat al-Nusra, alleged clashes between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, in Aleppo. And while the SMC would like to make it out, while pro-SMC circles would like to make it out that all FSA groups are anti-ISIS, that's not really the case. The FSA an FSA military council in Aleppo put out a statement recently. They said, no, these claims of clashes between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS are false. To understand why the SMC wants to say, Jabhat al-Nusra is fighting ISIS, is because it's building on a narrative that some rebels wanted to put out to Reuters, the news outlet, in May and June, that Jabhat al-Nusra members were considering to team up with other rebels against ISIS. And that's not really borne out on the ground, but they want to push that narrative because, the US has designated Nusra a terrorist organization. But, they want to work with us. I think the SMC, just trying to push for Western arms, hoping they can, hope they can muster all other forces to take on ISIS. But as I say, it's not the way they're trying to make it out. Is the picture they're painting isn't quite actually borne out on the ground. Actually, there was an amusing video recently of a Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS supporters having a friendly game of tug of war in Aleppo, and it was quite funny and friendly. But that reflects what jihadi ideologues on forums have envisioned in terms of the fact that Baghdadi rejected Zawahiri's order. They think if he insists on retaining the name of ISIS, then let it be, but make sure it's, at the most, it's just friendly competition with Nusra, who can take out the most regime supporters and who can take out most of the regime forces and so on. And it's not really, meant to actually be fighting each other, just be friends, but, no problem, no harm in a little competition. To sum up, I'd say that, it's complex. Overall, it's a very complex picture. And I think trying to pose strict dichotomies of FSA versus Islamists in general, or Salafis as nationalists versus these transnational jihadists and so on, it doesn't work out like that. It all varies on a place-to-place basis, but there's no doubt why pro-SMC circles are eager to portray everyone else as supposedly being against ISIS. it's a bid to try to get Western arms to convince the West to provide armed support for the uprising.
So I'm curious. I'm having a hard time sort of understanding their political goals of Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. Almost the description you've offered us is that they are really there just for the sake of violence and sort of, you know, either, you know, violence in terms of sectarian goals or in terms of, you know, for the sake of real religiosity or whatever. But I mean, what are the long-term political goals? I mean, are they, you know, in territory they're holding, are they building institutions? Are they sort of building a form of governance and a form of rule, or is it really, you know, violence for the sake of, you know, jihad, or violence for the sake of sectarianism?
Oh no, definitely there are political goals. Definitely, no doubt about that. And as I say, you know, both being pledged to Al-Qaeda, that entails a transnational outlook of, you know, trying to set up an Islamic state. But, you know, going beyond these, what they see as artificial borders, just you know, that are just dividing the Muslim Ummah as a whole. Of the two between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, I think ISIS makes more of a public show of saying we want a caliphate. So, you know, they do this all. They recently put out quite a number of pictures where they have, say, their local supporters, say, waving for, you know, holding banners, calling for the caliphate to be reestablished. But again, Jabhat al-Nusra is not free of that either. So when Ahrar al-Sham, in coordination with Jabhat al-Nusra, drove out the Farouk battalions from a town called Membij in rural Aleppo in early April, they then held a victory rally the next couple of days later. And over there, you could see all kinds of banners saying, you know, calling for a khilafah, chanting for a caliphate, banners saying the Ummah wants an Islamic caliphate, and so on. So there's no doubt there what Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS want. In terms of Ahrar al-Sham, again, as I say, there's a blurring between, you know, a goal of just an Islamic state in Syria and looking beyond Syria. My own inclination is to say that, you know, it's blurred at best for Ahrar al-Sham and the SIF, but I'd say they incline towards a more outward-looking approach. You know, jihad and trying to set up an Islamic state doesn't stop in Syria. In terms of structures they set up on the ground, well, I think ISIS offers the best case of what they're actually in towns that they control. They call them emirates. So they have a huge banner in Jarablus: Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham, Emirate of Jarablus. And they have provincial divisions. They say that the Islamic State of Iraq and Hisham, the province of Aleppo, the province of Damascus, the province of Deir ez-Zor, and so on. So there's no doubt that, you know, where ISIS does gain control in particular, they're trying to lay the foundations for, you know, what would eventually be at least an Islamic state extending throughout Syria and then expanding into Iraq, and then, you know, it's the prelude to a wider caliphate.
And then, you know, well, let me end on, you know, what has been the role of foreigners in terms of, or not foreigners, but sort of outside groups in sort of funding and arming Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. I mean, has this been, you know, are these, you know, funding flows coming from the Gulf and, you know, Sunnis in the Gulf, or is funding and arming more, you know, of a local nature? Are you talking about, you know,
I'd say it comes both, I think, play a role. Locals, local support. I think that's a key thing that people forget, you know, about, say, ISIS in particular, that it wouldn't be where it is now if it didn't have any kind of local support. And it quite clearly does have local support in a number of towns. You know, that has to be appreciated. I mean, people can't wish away ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra or the SIF. They're a reality on the ground. They have to be dealt with. As for other funding, I talked about the cross border between Iraq and Syria with Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. Also, yes, it's true, individuals from the Gulf, Syrian exiles in various locations, whether it's Turkey or the wider Arab world. In terms of the SIF, I think that presents a good problem for people about, say, looking at Saudi Arabia. What is the boundary in Saudi Arabia between public and private? You know, foundations say that might give money to SIF, you know, how closely linked are they really with the government? I think, but at the same time, you see that, say, Saudi Arabia led an initiative back in, say, January to give, you know, with the Croatian arms, to give Croatian weapons to those not perceived as, you know, hardline Islamist. And that was primarily through Deraa in southern Syria. But you see that, you know, that I'd say the Saudi policy on that is a dysfunctional mess. You know, they want to both, in the same way in Egypt, you know, that they might be backing Salafists in Egypt, but they also, they're clearly backing non-Salafi elements in the military who, you know, help depose the Muslim Brotherhood government. So say, you know, I think Saudi policy on Syria also can be seen as a dysfunctional mess in the same way, with the same problems of lack of distinction between private and public. So that's, I'd say, the main sort of funding from outside for these Islamist groups. It's, you know, cross borders of Iraq and the wider Gulf and the wider Arab world, whether through exiles or Gulf Arabs and so on.
Interesting. So, I mean, you know, before we end the interview, you know, I always like to ask the guests to give us, you know, either, you know, is there something we left out? Do you want to leave us with a sort of summary or encapsulation comment? You know, the last word is always with the guests. So, you know, give us a sort of...
Summary. I think a summary, because I think I covered the points there. Just to emphasize. So on the Al-Qaeda level of the insurgency, there is a split at the leadership level between Julani of Jabhat al-Nusra and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. However, it doesn't always mean that on the ground, Jabhat al-Nusra members are angry or are hostile towards ISIS and vice versa. Although, there, of course, there are undoubtedly places where there are tensions. The second point I'd emphasize is I think one has to be careful about the myth. I think, strictly saying, just the SIF, Syrian Islamic Front, the Salafi coalition battalions are, you know, strictly nationalist is, I think that's a myth. And I think one has to be very aware of the blurring, say, between national and transnational, say, in the discourse of Ahrar al-Sham. The third point I'd make is, again, also with the, in terms of the ratio of these Salafist and hardline Islamists with other rebel battalions. Firstly, the Salafis can always be expected to side with JNN and ISIS if they're in if there's a conflict of a non-Islamist group of rivals. And not all those who go by the label of FSA are inherently hostile to ISIS. Actually, it's more people who are identifying with the SMC and trying to get Western arms. So that'd be my. So I think that'd be the three most important points I could pick out from. Those most important points I pick out from my interview to summarize for the guests.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.